All right, we're here with Elizabeth Wilson. Elizabeth is the inaugural director of the Arthur L. Irving Institute for Energy and Society at Dartmouth University. She's also a professor in the Environmental Studies Department there. Elizabeth has a degree, got her doctorate in engineering and public policy at Carnegie Mellon. We want to talk to her today about her work in particular on governance of RTOs and decision-making within regional transmission organizations, the nonprofit entities that manage competitive wholesale electricity markets. So, Elizabeth, thanks so much for sitting down today.
Thanks, David. I'm really happy to be here.
I want to talk about three of your papers specifically, and each one deals with a different RTO. And I want to start with the one that deals with the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator, in whose footprint you used to live, right? I want to get a sense from you about why you were interested in this project, how you approached it, and then we'll delve into the conclusions.
Yeah, so my research is really interested in how energy systems change, how they've changed in the past, how they're changing in the future, and how that works in practice. With a graduate student, Nathan Payne, we had done a small study with some colleagues in Minnesota looking at pumped hydro energy storage, and we started to look at energy markets and energy market rules. And what we found out was from this small little pumped hydro project in northern Minnesota, where whether or not it makes sense to build it is immaterial, but looking at those energy prices and then looking at the market rules, we were able to earn 40% more if that pumped hydro facility was able to also bid into ancillary service markets, you know, the grid balancing and load following services. And that was in the MISO footprint. And then we asked ourselves, well, what would happen if we used the rules that they use in ISO New England? And so he coded in those other rules, and we found that we changed the value of the plant by 240%. And so this idea of rules, tools, and jewels and how the energy fits together in practice and how it's socially negotiated became something that really interested me. And so with Seth Blumsack at Penn State, Natalie Nelson Marsh at Boise State, and Dave Solon, who was then at Boise State too, we wrote an NSF grant looking at regional transmission organizations, because here's a place where the rules are socially negotiated. They're not handed down by Moses on stone tablets, right? They're negotiated in the reliability subcommittee and the market subcommittee. And we wanted to think about RTOs as boundary organizations, this kind of thematic approach that RTOs, regional transmission organizations, are bringing people with very different interests together to make collective decisions. And so our initial idea was a beautiful comparative study looking at MISO, looking at CAISO, and looking at PJM, where we're going to be studying the long-distance transmission and multi-state cooperations, as well as integration of variable resources into energy markets. And so that first paper was actually the only place where that study design actually worked. And it worked because that's what they were talking about at MISO. And we were able to examine through the creation of the multi-value projects, which was the first time that an RTO had been able to share the costs of these. So we looked at, you know, the building of big infrastructure and planning activities, and then we looked at the collective changing of reliability subcommittee, market subcommittee, planning subcommittee to allow wind to participate in those markets. And what we appreciated was, well, A, transmission is blood sport. Building transmission is always really, really hard because, like you talked about with your energy trade-offs or energy negotiations, you know, who pays for that infrastructure is really tricky. And so how they negotiated that through the MISO process was something that was really fascinating for all of us. And then looking also at the changes in market rules. Now, I don't think a lot of people appreciate that RTOs are structured in many ways like utilities are structured, where you have a group that's concerned with reliability, you have a group that's concerned with markets, and you have a group that's concerned with operations. I remember in one of the meetings, one of the reliability people said, hey, I'm the good guy. I'm the reliability guy that's trying to keep the lights on. I'm not that market person that's, you know, trying to just make money off this system. I want to make sure the system works. And so those tensions that you see in the utility space, you also see at the RTO level. And so I really do think that thinking about RTOs as boundary organizations is something that is really a useful framework, because you have very different interests coming together in the RTO space that are being negotiated to solve really complex problems.
Yeah, one of the papers on MISO that came out of that, I think, was this paper looking at the negotiations, or I guess negotiations is the right word, for within the RTO to develop new rules for integrating wind.
The DIR, the Dispatchable Intermittent Resources.
Right, integrating wind into the MISO footprint. And one of the interesting things about the way you characterize that is that there's a really strong sort of organizational cultural component.
Each really have distinctive cultures. And that within the creation of the Dispatchable Intermittent Resources rule, you had some people at MISO who would say, you know, MISO is not a policy maker. We, you know, take the state's policies and we run our system to allow those to happen. And so with the creation of the Dispatchable Intermittent Resources Program, what struck me was in some ways how much easier it was than the changes in, or than building the transmission lines. What MISO did that I thought was so interesting was instead of saying, oh, wind is variable, we can't deal with it, they said, well, we have the control systems in place. We have the weather modeling in place. Let's treat wind like any other resource and let it bid into the markets. And in the short term, wind is persistent. So 10 minutes before dispatch, allow it to true up. That said, I was just last week, we had some colleagues from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission here, and they were talking about an unknown operator who may be gaming the system a little bit with those rules. So, you know, the story and saga continues.
Yeah, that never ends. It's like tax compliance, right? If you create some rules, people are going to find ways to.
Yeah, it's like water running through the cracks.
Let's talk about California, because you did a paper on the California Energy Imbalance Market, or CAISO's the attempt to sort of create the organization through which that market came about and was governed. And that too is its own story, its own interesting sort of social cultural story.
Our plan was to go into California, look at large scale transmission, and then look at wind integration into the markets, just like we were doing at MISO. So we showed up at CAISO. Stephanie Lenhart did her PhD in this topic. She's at Boise State now. She's fabulous. And the great thing about Stephanie, who was at Boise State, advised by Natalie Nelson Marsh, in part, doing this work, was she was outside of California. And so we were really able, through the creation of what they now call the Western Energy Imbalance Market, to explore some of those political tensions from the Western perspective. And you know, there are a lot of colleagues from the California side that were really afraid that the Western EIM would erode California's policy primacy and ability to kind of govern its energy future. And to get the perspective from the people from the West of, we don't want California with its high cost energy to come and tell us what to do. I mean, that tension was huge. And so how these different groups had to kind of come together and negotiate why this was beneficial, right? So for the Western states, it was really hard to integrate variable resources like wind. They didn't have the ability to deal with transmission congestion or any of that energy imbalancing that a market structure lets you do a little bit more easily. And so there was an interest to kind of think about not a full-scale RTO, but a partial-scale service model that could allow them to kind of better schedule and better integrate some of their system intricacies.
What was the problem that California was trying to solve?
Well, California has a huge commitment to renewable green power, and doing it was not something they could really do on their own. It really is a place where they're not going to be able to meet their policy goals unless they're able to kind of expand this footprint a little bit larger. And from the Western perspective, having some tools available to do this was also, you know, kind of an important one. And so when we studied the EIM Transitional Committee and its foundation, That was really what we were focusing on in that paper, those, again, what is the problem and how are they trying to crosswalk it and solve it?
Well, you know, it's a big, long, tall state with a whole bunch of solar east of Lode, right? It sure would be nice to spread their market into other places and be able to take advantage of that.
Well, and that's actually one thing that I really appreciated as well, is oftentimes our energy problems are self-created. I mean, you're sitting in Texas. A lot of ERCOT problems are because ERCOT wants to be ERCOT and doesn't want to connect with anyone else, right? And you say, oh, this is a huge problem. You're like, well, yeah, but you made the problem.
One of the things that really struck me in this paper was another sort of cultural, or maybe it's more of a persuasion item, but you mentioned in the paper that it was important not to call it an RTO to success. Can you just say a little bit about why that was?
There is, in the West, and you're from Texas, you appreciate this, the fondness towards the federal government running your energy system is a little less obvious. And the idea of an RTO that would have full control and be able to kind of more actively insert itself into your energy system operations was something that a lot of the participants did not favor. I know that from the FERC perspective, they'd love it if it was like a full this or a full that. But one of the things I really appreciated, not only is every RTO is quite different and almost embeds a balkanized logic of its own. I mean, now I'm living in ISO New England, and I only realized kind of last week one of the reasons that we don't have good natural gas here is because of New York. You can't site a pipeline through New York. And New York is on that side. New York is on the south side. Right? You can't, unless you're bringing it in from Canada. And so siting energy infrastructure in New England is kind of crazy hard. Or I guess they say wicked hot.
Wicked hot. Yeah, we have another conversation with James Coleman about that issue on the website. But, yeah, that's obviously a really hot issue right now.
And when we were dancing around the topic of the creation of the EIM out west, we didn't even talk about, you know, Bonneville Power or a lot of those western dams, right? I mean, getting those organizations involved when they're not only producing energy, but they're also doing flood control, they're doing salmon runs, they're
irrigation,
irrigation. Their jobs are so much bigger than just energy. So how you integrate those multifaceted entities into an electricity market, I think, is another huge question.
Let's turn to this last article, which is more of an, I guess it's more of a sort of structured essay about the Texas experience. You sort of apply this idea of sustainability science to the to frame the growth of wind power in Texas. And there's a whole other sort of set of sort of cultural and persuasion sort of elements to the way the story unfolds there.
Well, one of the things that I have loved about Texas is Texas is an energy state. Texas is also a wind state. I mean, wind developed Texas. From the first trains that went across the state, you had big tanks of water and a windmill pumping the water. When you see those pictures of early Texas towns, it was every house with its own windmill pumping water. I mean, wind was used to pump the first oil in some places, and still on some of the ranches, you depend on wind for water, right? Or like it's part of the landscape for such a long time. And I know that Galbraith, what's her first name?
Kate.
Just a super book on kind of the Great Texas Wind Rush. I really love that for some of the history. When thinking about wind in the modern era, I first got interested in this in a project when I was looking at carbon capture and sequestration and wind side by side, but in different U.S. contexts. And so we had a bunch of interviews with people in Minnesota, Montana, Massachusetts, and then Texas. We do have data that proves Texans talk 25% more than any of our other participant states.
That's great.
Yeah. Totally blew our transcription budget, right? Because we really did it on the Minnesotan that don't talk very much, and then we get the Texan, and there goes the budget.
Yeah.
But what I appreciated was how the story of why we're doing wind, why we fund the CREZ, how we do wind integration, how wind is like facilitated now, the oil and gas fracking boom, it's a completely different story. And it's one that, you know, is based on logics that are distinctive. I mean, when we were doing a media analysis of the Texas Wynn papers from the Houston Chronicle, I think it's about 2007, 2008, I want to say 70% of the articles were appearing in the business section of the Houston Chronicle. Over the front page, but it was a distinctive story. And the story you had at that point was T. Boone Pickens, I think it was. You had high natural gas prices, and so wind was cheap. And so even though your policy environment wasn't particularly strong for wind, it was just going gangbusters. And then you looked at the kind of co-adjacent transmission build project. Do you know how much you guys spent on credits total? Like $6.2 billion? And the way that you paid for it in Texas, where everyone is sharing these costs, you don't call it socialization. You call it like uplift or something like that, right?
Yeah, but it is. It's socializing the cost. Yeah.
Yeah. So, the foundational undergarments of the energy system.
Yes. But the point you're making about sort of how it was framed, I find fascinating in this paper, because you quote somebody in Texas saying that climate change is, quote, a pariah term. And that really this was sold as an economic development or a rural economic development process. And so your point about the business section carrying the wind development stories makes perfect sense. And then that sort of fit the Texas zeitgeist to sort of frame it that way. But the other thing that's interesting in this paper is wind, advocates of wind, who really were interested in climate change, were part of a set of forces that led to restructuring and SB7, and opening up the market to competitive forces in Texas. We always hear about that as sort of an Enron story, but this paper tells recounts the participation of these wind advocates as part of that process.
And it's interesting to think about how in different configurations, in different contexts, you have these constellations of actors coming together, you know, to support different policies or push other things away. And that's why for me, energy policy in this country, around the world, it's just so fascinating.
Yeah.
You never get bored with what we do, because everywhere it's a story of technology, but it's also a deeply human story.
Yeah, I agree. It's never a dull moment in this field. And one other thing I really like about these papers collectively is that they really illustrate just how much is going on inside of RTOs, and really how many of these what I would call trade-offs get sort of negotiated inside the RTOs, because FERC has given RTOs such broad leeway to make a lot of these decisions. And so really, even if the people inside the RTOs feel as if they're policy takers, they're doing more than that. They're making a lot of decisions that are really important and have a lot of and have very high consequences.
Well, and one of the things I've appreciated is, you know, FERC often sees their role as managing the RTOs. From the RTO's perspective, they're trying to manage FERC.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting kind of, you know, how do we do this policy so we can make it do this or not make it do that? How do we make sure we can get through this and not get through that? So there's a lot of learning that's happening as well. One of the things that I've really appreciated, too, when we are able to get people who work at the RTOs out of that context and into a broader forum, is while they have structured meetings like the ISO RTO forum every year, they don't have too much time just to talk to each other. Like, why does this happen this way? Why does that happen that way? And when you actually get really knowledgeable people in a room, it makes me appreciate that there's some really big questions that we should be asking in our scholarship, but we don't know enough to ask, in part because they're so hard and impenetrable organizations for the outsider. I mean, you don't have 300 hours for meetings each year, neither do I.
Right.
So to participate, you know, utilities will have a team of people engaged in these different organizations. So the scholarship is both easy and hard.
Agreed. Thanks so much for sitting down to talk with us.
It's so fun to talk to you, David. Anytime.